is Americana.
Yet the average man is responsible for his own sanity. Even if he is entirely incurious, he is still subjected to an unremitting discipline by words. Words fired at him day and night. These words attack more than his pocketbook. They work on his dreams and his way of life.
The words you have just heard were written by David Cort in his recent book, The Big Picture. This program is Americana, the 20th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you The Writer in Person.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. The other day, while I was waiting in a railroad station for my train to come in, I spent 10 or 15 minutes, more or less out of habit, and staring at the great racks of magazines, newspapers, and pocketbooks which adorned the newsstand. And as it happened, I found a very new book which I immediately bought. Its title is Great Essays, and its editor is Houston Peterson. Now, in order to reach this volume of Great Essays, I had to pass over at least 50 books which appeared from their covers, titles, and descriptive blurbs to deal with the subjects of sex and violence in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. After I'd sat down again with my new volume, I began to speculate a little on the curious aspects of this situation. For I must confess that I'm genuinely fond of reading essays which touch on a great variety of themes, few of which are dramatic, and touch on them rather gently. Yet it would appear, on a kind of a pseudo-mathematical basis, that there must be at least 50 people in the world who prefer the violence, drama, and monotony of contemporary popular fiction to the much more placid and various offerings of the essays. Why should this be? I opened my new book and found Mr. Houston Peterson talking more or less on this subject.
To put the matter briefly, I like to read certain kinds of essays. I know nothing pleasanter than to sit down for half an hour or so with Montaigne or Bacon, with Lamb or Hazlitt, with James Thurber or E.B. White. I don't expect to be cornered or conquered by them, but I do expect to join in their wandering reflection. Their letters, even when published, were not written to me, but their essays were, to thousands of me's, and I'm deeply grateful. In a mechanized assembly line world, these personal contacts are very satisfying. While others are reading mystery stories or keeping up with the novel, I like to go on a little excursion with genial minds, perhaps to be influenced, but never overpowered.
Now let me underscore, if I may, 2 points which Mr. Peterson suggests. One is this matter of the intimate, intensely personal contact with another human being, which we make when reading essays. About that point, we shall have much more to say later on. The other is the low-pressure tone, which is characteristic of most essays. When you read this sort of literature, you are, as Mr. Peterson says, perhaps influenced, but never overpowered. The provision of the low-pressure, non-coercive word is a real service to humanity in these days. I was reminded by Mr. Peterson's remark of something that I had read in David Cort's recent book, The Big Picture, which is, incidentally, a kind of extended essay. Mr. Cort opens his book with a chapter entitled Bedlam. In it, he talks about the curious plight of ordinary people in our modern, super-organized world.
Yet the average man is responsible for his own sanity. Even if he is entirely incurious, he is still subjected to an unremitting discipline by words. Words fired at him day and night. These words attack more than his pocketbook. They work on his dreams and on his way of life. So fine, so light, so pale, so right. Brimming, bubbling goodness. Cool and filtered. Real, deep down, smoking enjoyment. Petal soft. Kissable. The one fine car. Getaway power. Pure and mild. If only he can find out about life and time, he may at least save a little money. If not, he'll be forever the plaything of such nouns as power, sparkle, wind and zest, and the elite adjectives smooth, cool, soft, sweet, deep, fine, rich, light, bold, firm, and fresh, and of still other words which are trying to bend him to his will. With the increase of literacy and the oral literacy of radio, words actually for some people have taken the place of the phenomena they presume to describe. Words alone can make them angry or ashamed, docile or affectionate, regardless of the actual phenomenon. These people may be uneducated or scholarly, clever or stupid, but they will slug their best friends on the absolute rule, so unrehearsed that it's instinctual, "Nobody can say that to me." They will see the qualities in another person only after somebody else has put them into words, even the wrong words.
This passage describes with uncommon neatness a perversion of language with which we're all familiar. In our time, largely because of the amazing advances in communications, we've become familiar with the word which is a substitute for reality, with the word which is spoken by nobody in particular, the word which in and of itself generates an explosive social force as terrible as that created by the splitting of an atom. The essay, you see, provides us with a kind of antidote to this sort of language, an intellectual bomb shelter, if you like, to cushion us against the shock of exploding syllables, for the essayist is always present in his essay. There's never any doubt about who's speaking, and there is never any doubt that what he says is a personal, individualized picture of a segment of the world. The essayist may speak passionately or calmly, with the quiet friendliness of an E.B. White or the cantankerousness of a Mencken, but he always says, "This is how the world looks to me. This is what I know about human beings. This is how I interpret their actions." And these voices, sometimes right, sometimes mistaken, but always human and real, create little oases of sanity in a world often parched and dry. Now, you might reasonably ask at this point, why a discussion of essays, the classic examples of which were certainly written by Englishmen on a program called Americana? There are two answers. One is that we have had more fine American essayists than we have ever really recognized or appreciated. The other answer is that the essay is so intensely personal that when American essayists speak to us, they speak as our compatriots, in the terms of experience and outlook which we all share. They cannot do otherwise. These are intensely American voices, and what they have to say to us, since it reflects so accurately a time, a place, and a certain conditioning, is in itself Americana. I think I could safely assure you that Court's observations on man could have been written by no one save an American, and at no time save the present segment of the 20th century. Sometimes, of course, American essayists deal with materials which are immediately recognizable as American. This is the case of Leo Gurko and his current book, Heroes, Highbrows, and the Popular Mind. This book is actually a collection of related essays, the common conclusion of which is that there is a powerful feeling against the intellectual, and indeed against rational thought in American life. Gurko's thesis about American folk heroes and literary heroes is that they tend universally to be men of action and rugged individualists. Here, for example, is Mr. Gurko dealing with the standard content of the last three chapters in a Western novel.
We are now down to chapter 13, and it's time for the Deus Ex Machina. Three cartridges from the end of the hero's arsenal, hoofs are heard from the horizon, and in due course, the rescue party from the home ranch sweeps into sight, scattering the rustlers to the four winds. If the Western has a military background, the rescue party is announced by bugles and appears in the shape of the U.S. cavalry from the nearby military fort. The foreman, in the meantime, has made his escape, making it necessary for Chapter 14 to be devoted to the pursuit by the cowboy and the final gun duel as its calculable end. Chapter 15 winds up loose ends and is climaxed by the cowboy's declaration of love. This in itself is a supreme example of pathos. Though long on action, the cowboy is short on words, and his emotions, throbbing since he first laid eyes on the heroine, have not yet found expression. The moment, however, has come, and he can no longer avoid it. On the last page, riding with his lady toward a beautiful sunset, his heart choked with feelings that have long since outrun his vocabulary, he finally makes a supreme effort. His voice trembling slightly with strain, his passions at the flood, he manages to utter what is surely one of the immortal declarations of American literature.
I guess I kind of like you, gal.
In short, Mr. Gurko suggests that the American world is a fine place for the man of action who never stops to think, but that it tends to be a pretty cheerless and depressing place for the person whose life is lived chiefly within his own cranium. He sums up the matter in this way.
America is the only country in the world, a columnist once observed, where a man who uses a word that isn't understood by another man is made to feel inferior to that other man. To be suspected of learning, or what is worse, to display it publicly, is to invite ridicule. In our national stereotype, college professors are looked on as usually old, so wrapped up in musty and useless books that they have lost touch with life. Artists are supposed to be unconventional fellows, to be envied perhaps in one's duller moments, but kept firmly outside the pale of respectable society. Now, many people regard the intellectual as a snob, and the word itself has acquired an unpleasant flavor. Women especially are sensitive to it. Call a woman an intellectual, and she's likely to feel insulted. You have as much as said that she's without feminine charm, and must make up in brains what nature denied her in beauty. Here, as so often elsewhere, cultivation of the mind is regarded as a poor substitute for living.
Of course, I don't wholly believe Mr. Gurko, although he is both witty and learned. The prejudice against thinking, which he discusses at such length, is not the only attitude which we Americans display toward learning. Neither is this outlook wholly American, as the late John Erskine pointed out in an essay written 40 years ago called The Moral Obligation to Be Intelligent.
The disposition to consider intelligence a peril is an old Anglo-Saxon inheritance. Our ancestors have celebrated this disposition in verse and prose. Splendid as our literature is, it has not voiced all the aspirations of humanity, nor could it be expected to voice an aspiration that does not characteristically belong to the English race. The praise of intelligence is not one of its characteristic glories. Be good, sweet maid, and let who will be clever. Here is the startling alternative which to the English, alone among the great nations, has not been startling but a matter of course. Here is the casual assumption that a choice must be made between goodness and intelligence, that stupidity is first cousin to moral conduct, and cleverness the first step into mischief, that reason and God are not on good terms with each other, that the mind and the heart are minor buckets in the well of truth, inexorably balanced. Full mind, starved heart. Stout heart, weak head.
If it is true, as Mr. Erskine points out, that English literature has never sung the praises of intelligence, the same can surely not be said for certain segments of American literature, and particularly for the essay. I cite as an example this brief selection from H.L. Mencken's diatribe entitled The Sahara of the Bozart.
Alas, for the South, her books have grown fewer. She never was much given to literature. In the lamented J. Gordon Kugler, author of these elegiac lines, there was the insight of a true poet. He was the last bard of Dixie, at least in the legitimate line. Down there, a poet is now almost as rare as an oboe player, a dry point etcher, or a metaphysician. It is indeed amazing to contemplate so vast a vacuity. One thinks of the interstellar spaces, of the colossal reaches of the now mythical ether. Nearly the whole of Europe could be lost in that stupendous region of fat farms, shoddy cities, and paralyzed cerebrums. One could throw in France, Germany, and Italy and still have room for the British Isles. And yet, for all its size and all its wealth and all the progress it babbles of, it is almost as sterile, artistically, intellectually, and culturally, as the Sahara Desert. There are single acres in Europe that house more first-rate men than all the states south of the Potomac. If the whole of the late Confederacy were to be engulfed by a tidal wave tomorrow, the effect upon the civilized minority of men in the world would be but little greater than that of a flood on the Yangtze Kiang. It would be impossible in all our history to match so completely a drying up of a civilization.
I had better add hastily that the opinions expressed in this paragraph are not necessarily mine, and perhaps not even Mr. Mencken's anymore. As an antidote to Mr. Mencken, I offer the late Robert Benchley. A short meditation by Mr. Benchley appears in the Great Essays collection. It's entitled simply, My Face.
Merely as an observer of natural phenomena, I'm fascinated by my own personal appearance. This does not mean that I'm pleased with it, mind you, or that I can even tolerate it. I simply have a morbid interest in it. Each day I look like someone or something different. I never know what's going to be until I steal a look in the glass, so I don't suppose you could really call it stealing. It belongs to me, after all. But one day I look like Wimpy, the hamburger fancier in the Popeye the Sailor saga. Another day it may be Wallace Beery. And the third day, if I've let my mustache get out of hand, it's Burns' father's old Bill. And not until I peek do I know what the show is going to be. Some mornings, if I look in the mirror soon enough after getting out of bed, there is no resemblance to any character at all, either in or out of fiction. And I quickly turn to look behind me, convinced that the stranger has spent the night with me and is peering over my shoulder in a sinister fashion merely to frighten me. On such occasions, the shock of finding that I am actually the possessor of the face in the mirror is sufficient to send me scurrying back to bed and completely unnerved.
I suppose that the two finest living American essayists are James Thurber and E.B. White. This winter has been a very good season for connoisseurs of the essays, since both Thurber and White have published new collections within the past few months. Mr. Thurber's book came out last fall. It's called Thurber Country. I think that the best thing you can possibly do with Thurber Country is to get hold of the book and read it. And perhaps the best thing that I can do about it is to urge you to read the book. It would not be right, however, to miss this opportunity of quoting a little Thurber for you. For my taste, one of the most delightful essays in the collection is the one which the author calls What a Lovely Generalization.
What I collect now is a certain kind of broad generalization or sweeping statement. You'll see what I mean when I bring out some of my rare and cherished pieces. All you need to start a collection of generalizations like mine is an attentive ear. Listen in particular to women, whose average generalization is from, 3 to 5 times as broad as a man's. Generalization, male or female, may be true. Women don't sleep very well. Untrue, there are no pianos in Japan. Or half true, people would rather drink than go to the theater. I haven't space here to go through my entire collection, but there is room to examine a few more items. I'm not sure where I got hold of gamblers hate women, but like sopranos drive men crazy, it has an authentic ring. Now, there may be something to dogs know when you're despondent, and sick people hear everything, but I sharply question the validity of nobody taps his fingers if he's all right. Now, if you're going to start collecting sweeping statements on your own, I must warn you that certain drawbacks are involved. You'll be inclined to miss the meaning of conversations while lying in wait for generalizations. Your mouth will hang open slightly, your posture will grow rigid, and your eyes will take on the rapt expression of a person listening for the faint sound of distant sleigh bells. People will avoid your company and whisper that you are probably a finger-tapper who's a long way from being all right. But your collection will be a source of comfort in your declining years when you can sit in a chimney corner cackling the evening away over some such gems, let us say, as my own two latest acquisitions. Jewelers never go anywhere, and intellectual women dress funny. Good hunting.
Your adventures with Mr. Benchley and Mr. Thurber will always, I suppose, have a certain quality of fantasy to them, an Alice in Wonderland sort of feel. But the atmosphere and the climate in the world of Mr. E.B. White are very different. Here is an intensely human world, an eminently sane world, and all the more charming because of its reality. I think I can show you what I mean by quoting one of Mr. White's best essays, which appears in his new collection, The Second Tree from the Corner. This is his farewell, written in 1936, to the Model T Ford. It's called Farewell, My Lovely.
I see by the new Sears Roebuck catalog that it's still possible to buy an axle for a 1901 Model T Ford. But I'm not deceived. No, the great days have faded. The end is in sight. Only one page in the current catalog is devoted to parts and accessories for the Model T. Yet everyone remembers spring times when the Ford gadget section was larger than men's clothing, almost as large as household furnishings. The last Model T was built in 1927, and the car is fading from what scholars call the American scene, which is an understatement because to a few million people who grew up with it, the old Ford practically was the American scene. It was the miracle God had wrought, and it was patently the sort of thing that could only happen once. Mechanically uncanny, it was like nothing that had ever come to the world before. Flourishing industries rose and fell with it. As a vehicle, it was hard-working, commonplace, heroic. And it often seemed to transmit those qualities to the persons who rode in it. My own generation identifies it with youth, with its gaudy, irretrievable excitements. Before it fades into the mist, I would like to pay it the tribute of the sigh that is not a sob, and set down random entries in a shape somewhat less cumbersome than a Sears Roebuck catalog. Springtime in the heyday of the Model T was a delirious season. Owning a car was still a major excitement. Roads were still wonderful and bad. The Fords were obviously conceived in madness. Any car which was capable of going from forward into reverse without any perceptible mechanical hiatus was bound to be a mighty challenging thing to the human imagination. Boys used to veer their Fords off the highway into a pasture and run wild with them as though they were cutting up with a girl. Most everybody used the reverse pedal quite as much as the regular foot brake. It distributed the wear over the bands and wore them all down evenly. That was the big trick, to wear all the bands down evenly so that the final chattering would be total and the whole unit would scream for renewal. Ah, the days were golden. The nights were dim and strange. I still recall with trembling those loud nocturnal crises when you drove to a signpost and raced the engine so the lights would be bright enough to read destinations by. I've never been really planetary since. And I suppose it's time to say goodbye. Farewell, my lovely.
As you can see from this, Mr. White is at his best when he's talking about the facts of life. By which I mean such things as the Model T Ford, the United Nations, the oddities of himself and his fellow men, and sometimes the city in which he lives. I suppose that the most frequently reprinted of White's essays is his sketch called Here is New York, which incidentally does not appear in The Second Tree from the Corner, but which you can read in Houston Peterson's great essays. I should like to have you listen to the last two or three paragraphs of this essay. It suggests far better than anything I can say to you the nature of the heights to which the American essay can rise and has risen.
The subtlest change in New York is something people don't speak about much. But it's in everybody's mind. The city, for the first time in its long history, is destructible. A single flight of planes, no bigger than a wedge of geese, can quickly end this island fantasy, burn the towers, crumble the bridges, turn the underground passages into lethal chambers, cremate the millions. The intimation of mortality is part of New York now, and the sounds of jets overhead in the black headlines of the latest edition. It used to be that the Statue of Liberty was the signpost that proclaimed New York and translated it for all the world. Today, liberty shares the role with death. Along the East River, from the raised slaughterhouses of Turtle Bay, as though in a race with the spectral flight of planes, men are carving out the permanent headquarters of the United Nations, the greatest housing project of them all. This race between the destroying planes and the struggling parliament of man, it sticks in all our heads. The city at last perfectly illustrates both the universal dilemma and the general solution. This riddle in steel and stone is at once the perfect target and the perfect demonstration of nonviolence, of racial brotherhood. This lofty target scraping the skies and meeting the destroying planes halfway, home of all people and all nations, capital of everything, housing the deliberations by which the planes are to be stayed and their errand forestalled. A block or two west of the new city of man in Turtle Bay, there's an old willow tree that presides over an interior garden. It's a battered tree, long-suffering and much climbed, held together by strands of wire, but beloved of those who know it. In a way, it symbolizes the city, living under difficulties, growth against odds, sap rise in the midst of concrete, and the steady reaching for the sun. Whenever I look at it nowadays and feel the cold shadow of the plains, I think this must be saved. This particular thing, this very tree. If it were to go, all would go. This city, this mischievous and marvelous monument, which not to look upon would be like death.
You have been listening to Americana, the 20th in a series of radio essays dealing with the American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Your readers were Claire Baum and myself, Bill Grissom. Engineering by Ed Goff. The books mentioned on tonight's program were Great Essays, edited by Houston Peterson and published by Pocket Books, David Cort's The Big Picture, published by Bob's Merrill, Leo Gerkel's Heroes, Highbrows, and the Popular Mind, also published by Bob's Merrill, James Thurber's Thurber Country, published by Simon & Schuster, and E.B. White's The Second Tree from the Corner, published by Harper. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network.